Hello everyone and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 10, 10th Century Tour, part 1. Today we are going to go on a grand tour of the kingdoms in and around Scotland in Britain, discussing who is ruling at this particular time, how is the Kingdom of England faring, how is the island tribes faring, Wales. This is going to take place in the mid-10th century, 950s AD, around Indulf's and Duff MacMalcolm's reign, which we discussed both of those reigns in the last episode, so please visit the last episode to get caught up. Obviously, it ended with Culain coming to the throne. This should give you the understanding of the politics of the main nations around this time, as these countries will grow and change as time passes, and alliances will begin to form as we enter the Middle Ages that we know of today. This is going to be a long episode. With this in mind, I think it's only advisable if we split this into two episodes so we can do it properly and give justice to those kingdoms around Scotland. So this first episode, first part, is going to be focused on Britain and the kingdoms in Britain, including Ireland. Next week's episode will be about the Scandinavian area, the Vikings, the European kingdoms, and finally we'll discuss Christianity as a whole, the Pope, and its effect that it's obviously had on Scotland at this time. So, sit back, relax, as we head back in time to go on a grand tour of Britain and Europe in the 950s AD. Now, the Kingdom of Strathclyde, as we discussed, was one of the early medieval kingdoms of Britain, located in the region the Welsh tribes referred to as the Old North, which comprised the Brythonic-speaking parts of what is now southern Scotland and northern England. This is somewhat south-westish to where the Kingdom of Alba currently resides. So north of Adrian's Wall is Strathclyde, and then further north is the Kingdom of Alba, heading all the way to the top of Scotland. This kingdom developed during Britain's post-Roman period. It is also known as Alt Cult, a Brythonic term, the medieval capital of the region. After the sack of Dumbarton Rock by a Viking army from Dublin in 870 AD, the name Strathclyde came into use, perhaps reflecting a move of the centre of the kingdom to Govan. In the same period, it was also referred to as Cumbria, and its inhabitants as Cumbrians. After 600 AD, information on the Britons of a cult becomes slightly more common in sources. However, historians have disagreed as to how these should be interpreted. Broadly speaking, they have tended to produce these theories which place the subject at the centre of the history of North Britain in the early historic period. The result is a series of narratives which cannot be reconciled. More recent historiography may have gone some way to addressing this problem. At the beginning of the 7th century, Gabrielle may have been the most powerful king in northern Britain, and Delrita was at its height. Aidan's byname in later Welsh poetry does not speak to a favourable reputation among the Britons of Alt, and it may be that he seized control of Alt Cult. Aidan's dominance came to an end around 604 AD, when his army, including Irish kings and Bernician exiles, was defeated by Ealfrith at the Battle of Degiston. It is supposed, on rather weak evidence, that Ealfrith, his successor Edwin, and Bernician and Northumbrian kings after them expanded into southern Scotland. Such evidence as there is, such as the conquest of Elmet, the wars in the North Wales and with Mercia, would argue for a more southerly focus of Northumbria activity in the first half of the 7th century. The report in the Annals of Ulster, one of our main primary sources for this episode, for 638 AD, the Battle of Glenmorison and the besieging of Ettin, later known as Edinburgh, has been taken to represent the capture of Edwin by the Northumbrian King Oswald, son of Ealfrith, but the annals mention neither capture nor Northumbrians, so this is rather a tenuous identification. In 642 AD, the Annals of Ulster report the Britons of Alt, led by Eugen, son of Beli, defeated the men of Delrita and killed Domica Breck, grandson of Aidan, at Strathcorn. And this victory is also recorded in the Wygodin source. The site of this battle is in the northern part of England known as Bannockburn, and the hills and lochs to the north which separated the lands of the Britons from those of the Dalrytans and the Picts, as we discussed in past episodes, and this land was not worth fighting for. However, the lands to the south and east of this waste were controlled by smaller, nameless British kingdoms. Powerful neighbouring kings, whether in Occult, Dalrita or Pictland or Benicia, would have imposed tribute on those petty kings, and wars for overlordship of this area seem to have been regular events in the 6th to 8th centuries. There are a few definitive reports of the occult in the remainder of the 7th century, although it is possible that the Irish annals contain entries that may be related to occult. In the last quarter of the 7th century, a number of battles in Ireland, largely in the areas along the Irish Sea, are reported to where Britons have taken part in. It is usually assumed that these Britons are mercenaries or exiles disposed by some Anglo-Saxon conquest in northern Britain. However, it may be that these represent campaigns by kings of occult, whose kingdom was certainly part of the region linked by the Irish Sea. All of occult's neighbours, Northumbria, Pictland, Dalrita, are known to have sent armies to Ireland on occasions. The Annals of Ulster in early 8th century report two battles between occult and Dalrita at Lom Eclet, which is an unknown location, in 711 AD, and at the rock called Mimerick in 717 AD. Whether their appearance in the record has any significance or whether it is just a happenstance is unclear. Later in the 8th century, it appears that the Pictish king Ongus made at least three campaigns against the occult, none of them being successful. In 744 AD, the Picts acted alone, and in 750 AD, the Picts may have cooperated with Egbert of Northumbria in a campaign in which Talgorn, brother of the king, was killed in a heavy Pictish defeat at the hands of Tenbrough of Occult, perhaps at Mugdock near Milngrave. Egbert is to have said have taken the plain of Kyle in 750 AD, around modern Ayr, presumably from Occult. Again, Occult is the kingdom of Strathclyde, just so we don't get any confusions. After this, little is heard of Occult or its kings until the 9th century. The burning, the usual term for the capture of Occult, is reported in the 780s AD, although by whom and in what circumstances is not known. If we move to the Viking Age, an army led by the Viking chiefs, known as Irish as Amgokok, laid siege in 870 AD to the occult land, a siege which lasted some 4 months and led to the destruction of the citadel and taking a very large number of captives. The siege and capture are reported by Welsh and Irish sources, and obviously the Annals of Ulster say that in 870 AD, after overwintering in Clyde, Imlib and Imar returned to Dublin from Alba with 200 ships, bringing away with them in captivity to Ireland a great prey of Angles and Britons and Picts. King Dumgal, called King of the Britons of the Strathclyde, was among the captives, and it is reported that he was killed in Dublin in 872 AD, thus one of their kings was dead. He was followed by his son, Run of Occult, who was married to Constantine's sister, Eochid. The result of this marriage may have been King of Strathclyde or of the Kingdom of Alba. From this time forward, and perhaps much earlier, the Kingdom of Strathclyde was subject to periodic domination by the Kings of Alba. However, the earlier idea that the heirs to the Scots throne ruled Strathclyde or Cumbria as an appanage has relatively little support, and the degree of Scots control should not be overstated. This period probably saw a degree of Norse or Norse-scale settlements in Strathclyde. A number of place names, if we look at them in particular, are clustered on the coast facing the Cumbries. Monuments such as Hogback Graves at Covan are some of the remains of these newcomers. Following the Battle of Bunbury, Owen became King of Strathclyde, perhaps reigning from 937 until 971 AD. It has been supposed that he was installed by the King MacCallum MacDonnell, to whom Edmund of Wessex had let the Kingdom of Strathclyde. But again, as with the ideas of appanage, this is probably to overstate the case and follow John of Fordon's version of history more closely than facts merit. Local tradition in English Cumbria recounts how Dunmail, the so-called last king of Cumbria, was killed at the Battle of Dunmail Raes in 945 AD, a large cairn on what was a boundary between Cumberland and Westmorland. This, the boundary between the Cumbrians and the English, marks where he was supposed to have fallen. His sons are said to have escaped up to the nearby mountain and thrown the Cumbrian crown jewels into a tarn before themselves being captured, blinded and castrated by the victorious English. During the High Middle Ages, the area was conquered by the Gaelic-speaking Kingdom of Alba in the 11th century, becoming part of the new Kingdom of Scotland. However, it remained a distinctive Brittonic area until the 12th and 13th centuries. And that is a brief summary of where the Kingdom of Strathclyde is up to. If we now move to our glorious nation of England, Wessex, or the Kingdom of the West Saxons, was an Anglo-Saxon kingdom in the south of Great Britain from 1519 AD, when the Saxons, Jutes and Angles came over from Europe to Britain and began to settle the area of England we know today. Until England was unified by Æthelstan in 927 AD, this area is at the very southwest of England, from Devon to Bristol of today, going all the way down to sea and then touching the Thames on the east near in London. The Anglo-Saxons believed that Wessex was founded by Cedric and Cynic, but this may be a legend. The two main sources for this, as always, is the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and the history of Wessex. In 802, the fortunes of Wessex were transformed by the accessions of Egbert, who came from a cadet branch of the ruling dynasty that claimed descent from Innsbruck's England. With his ascension, the throne became firmly established in the hands of a single lineage. Early in his reign, he conducted two campaigns, West Welsh, first in 813 AD, and then again at Guildford in 825 AD. During the course of these campaigns, he conquered the West Britons still in Devon and reduced those beyond the River Tamar, known as Cornwall, to the status of a vassal. In 825 AD or 826, he overturned the political order of England by decisively defeating King Beowulf of Mercia and seizing control of Surrey, Sussex, Kent and Essex from the Mercians, while with his help, East Anglia broke away from Mercian control, thus ended Mercian dominance in England. In 829 AD, he conquered Mercia, driving its king into exile, and secured acknowledgement of his overlordship from the King of Northumbria. He thereby became Bertwald, or High King of Britain. This position of dominance was short-lived, as Wigwulf returned and restored Mercian independence in 830 AD. But the expansion of Wessex across the southeastern England proved permanent. Egbert's later years saw the beginning of a Danish Viking raid on Wessex, which occurred frequently from 835 onwards. In 855 to 856 AD, Aethelwulf went on pilgrimage to Rome, and his eldest surviving son, Aethelwald, took advantage of his absence to seize his father's throne. On his return, Aethelwulf agreed to divide the kingdom with his son to avoid bloodshed, ruling the new territories in the east while Aethelwulf held the old heartland in the west. Aethelwulf was succeeded by each of his four surviving sons, ruling one after the other. This eventually ended up in the hands of Alfred the Great, the new King of Wessex. This occurred because the first two brothers died in wars with the Danes without issue, whilst his brother's sons were also too young to rule. In 865 AD, several of the Danish commanders combined their respective forces into one large army and landed in England. Over the following years, what became known as the Great Heathen Army overwhelmed the kingdoms of Northumbria and East Anglia. Then in 871 AD, the Great Summer Army arrived from Scandinavia to reinforce the Great Heathen Army. The reinforced army invaded Wessex. Although Alfred won some victories and succeeded in preventing the conquest of their kingdom, a number of defeats and heavy losses of men compelled Alfred to pay the Danes to leave Wessex. The Danes spent the next 4 years subduing Mercia, and some of them settled in Northumbria, but the rest returned to Wessex in 876 AD. Alfred responded effectively and was able, with little fighting, to bring about their withdrawal in 877 AD. A portion of the Danish army settled in Mercia, but at the beginning of 878 AD, the remaining Danes mounted a winter invasion of Wessex, taking Alfred by surprise and overrunning much of the kingdom. Alfred was reduced to taking refuge with a small band of followers in the marshes of Somerset Levels, but after a few months he was able to gather an army and defeat the Danes at the Battle of Edington. bringing about the withdrawal from Wessex to settle East Anglia. At the same time, Danish raids on the northern coast of France and Brittany occurred in 870s AD, prior to the establishment of Normandy in 911 AD, and recorded Danish alliances with both Bretons and Cornish may have resulted in the suppression of Cornish autonomy with the death by drowning of the king in 875 AD, as recorded in the Annals of Cambrai. No subsequent kings of Cornwall are recorded after this time, but Essay records Cornwall as a separate kingdom from Wessex until the 890s AD. In 879 AD, a Viking fleet that had assembled in the Thames estuary sailed across the channel to start a new campaign on the continent. The rampaging Viking army on the continent encouraged Alfred to protect his kingdom of Wessex. Over the following years, Alfred carried out a dramatic reorganisation of the government and defensive of Wessex, building warships, organising the army into two shifts which served alternatively, and established a system of fortified boroughs across the kingdom. This system is recorded in a 10th century document known as the Borough Hiddich, which details the location and garrison requirements of 33 forts, whose positioning ensured that no one in Wessex was more than a long day's ride from a place of safety. In 890s AD, these reforms helped him repulse an invasion of another huge Danish army, which was aided by the Danes settled in England with minimal losses. Alfred also returned reform in administration of justice. He issued a new law code and championed a revival of scholarship and education. He also gathered scholars from around England and elsewhere in Europe to his court, and with the help of their translated a range of Latin texts into English, did much of the work personally and orchestrated the composition of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, to which we are referencing in this piece. As a result of these literary efforts and political dominance of Wessex, the West Saxon dialect of this period became the standard written form of Old English for the rest of the Anglo-Saxon period and beyond. The Danish conquests had destroyed the kingdoms of Northumbria, East Anglia, and divided Mercia in half, with the Danes settling the north-east, while the south-west was left to the king Ceolwulf, allegedly a Danish puppet. When Ceolwulf's reign came to an end, he was succeeded as ruler of English Mercia, not by another king, but a mere ealdorman, Eofrald, who acknowledged Alfred's overlordship and then married his daughter. The process by which this transformation of status of Mercia took place is unknown, but it has left Alfred as the only remaining English king. Thus began the unification of England and the earldom of Wessex. After the invasions of 890s AD, Wessex and English Mercia continued to be attacked by the Danish settlers in England and by small Danish raiding forces from overseas, but these incursions were usually defeated, while there were no further major invasions from the continent. The balance of power tipped steadily in the favour of the English. In 911 AD, the ealdorman Ethelred died, leaving his widow, Alfred's daughter, in charge of Mercia. Alfred's son and successor, Edward the Elder, then annexed London, Oxford and the surrounding area, probably including Middlesex, Herefordshire, Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire, from Mercia to Wessex. Between 913 and 918 AD, a series of English offensive overwhelmed the Danes of Mercia and East Anglia, bringing all of England south of the Humber under Edward's power. In 918 AD, the sister of Edward and daughter of Alfred died, and Edward took direct control of Mercia, extinguishing what remained of its independence and ensuring that henceforth there would be only one king of the English. In 927 AD, Edward's successor Æthelstan conquered Northumbria, bringing the whole of England under one ruler for the first time. The Kingdom of Wessex had thus been transformed into the Kingdom of England. Thus, England, now as a single entity and no longer many Saxon kingdoms, was bordering Strathclyde and Alba. If we now look across the Irish Sea to Ireland, at the end of the 8th century, Ireland was Gaelic in terms of society, culture and language. People lived in rural communities, and the only larger settlements were monastic towns of varying sizes. The monasteries played an important part in society, not just with the regards to religious and cultural life, but also to the economy and politics. Christianisation had begun in the 5th century, and by the early 9th century, the island was almost entirely Christian. Ireland at this time was separated by many different tribes slash smaller kingdoms, such as the Kingdom of Munster, such as the County of Kilkenny, such as the King of Leinster. Similar to how England and its smaller Saxon kingdoms was vying for control of Ireland, these smaller kingdoms did the same, trying to establish overlordship over each other. But the Viking raids would prove to be a massive problem for the Irish compared to how it affected the English. The wind is fierce tonight. It tosses the sea's white mane. I do not fear the coursing of a quiet sea by the fierce warriors of Lochland. That is an anonymous poem in Gaelic being translated for us. The first recorded Viking raid in Irish history occurred in 795 AD when Vikings, possibly from Norway, looted the island of Lambay. This was followed by a raid on the coast of Brega in 978 AD and the raids on the coast in Connacht in 807 AD. These early Viking raids were generally small in scale and quick. These early raids interrupted the golden age of Christianity in Irish culture and marked the beginning of 200 years of intermittent warfare. The waves of Viking raiders plundered monasteries and towns throughout Ireland. Most of the early raiders came from fjords of western Norway. They are believed to have sailed first to Shetland, then south to Orkney. The Vikings would have then sailed down to the Atlantic coast of Scotland and then over to Ireland. During these early raids, the Vikings also travelled to the west coast of Ireland to the Skellige Islands, located off the coast of the County of Kerry. The early raids on Ireland seem to have been a strategic free enterprise, and named leaders appear in the Irish annals. From here, the next King of Munster in 820 AD began a 30-year domination by this branch, combining military campaigns with manipulation. He embarked on a policy of aggressive expansion to counter the growth in the southern part of Ireland. This intensified the raidings from the Vikings, causing more disparity and less unity. The Vikings' raids on Ireland resumed in 821 AD and intensified through the following years. They were also moving further inland to attack, often using rivers such as the Shannon and then retreating to their coastal bases. The raiding parties also increased in size, becoming regular armies. In 837 AD, the annals report a fleet of 60 longships carrying around 1,500 men and another one of similar size sailing up the River Bjorn, making their way into the inland territories and launching attacks on the lands of Brega in the south of County of Meath. In general, from 837 AD onward, larger Viking forces hit larger targets. This was such things as monastic towns of Slane, Conlad and Lismore, while smaller targets such as local churches with less material to be plundered may have escaped the Vikings' attention. One of the first named Viking leaders was Turgnus. The annals of the four masters connect him with the attacks on Maid, Conquiat and the church at Clanmuscle in 844 AD. He was captured and drowned, but he was still not the last Viking to invade. In 848 AD, a Norse army was defeated by Munster and Leinster. For the first time, the leader of the Vikings is described as royalty in Lochan. The High King of the Irish then defeated another army. These victories form the background of an embassy sent to the Frankish Emperor Charles the Bold, reported in the Annals of Brittany. In 853 AD, Olaf, identified as son of the King of Lochan, came to Ireland. Lochan has been understood as a district of present Norway. It is now considered more plausible that it refers to a Scandinavian colony in the Western Isles of Scotland. Olaf assumed leadership of the Vikings in Ireland, probably in the same way shared with his kinsman Ivar, first mentioned in the Irish Annals in 857 AD. Yes, that Ivar. Olaf and Ivar remained active in Ireland around the Irish Sea for the next two decades. The descendants of Ivar, the Umer, would proved to be an important political factor for the next two centuries. Ivar the Boneless and his family ruling the Man, for example, as well. The shift in alliances and power. A significant new trait from the middle of the 9th century was that the Norse now also entered alliances with various Irish rulers to try and contend for power. A group of Vikings led by Hingmund, who were forced out of Ireland were given permission by the Saxons to settle in the Wirral in the northwest of England. The Free Fragments refers to a district group of settlers living amongst these Vikings as Irishmen. Then the king, who was on the point of death, and the queen sent messengers to the Irishmen who were among the pagans, for where they were many Irish among pagans, to say to the Irishmen, life and health to you from the king of Saxons, who is in disease, and from his queen, who has all authority over the Saxons, and they are certain that you are true and trusty to them. Therefore you should take their side, for they did not bestow any greater honour to a Saxon warrior or cleric than to each warrior and cleric who came to them from Ireland. Because this immaculate race of pagans is equally hostile to you also. Further evidence of Irish presence in Wirral comes from the name of the village Araby in Wirral, which means farmstead of the Irishmen. The Vikings were able to exploit internal divisions in order to invade England and France. As Ireland was one of the most politically fractured countries at the time, it was a prime target for Viking conquest. Furthermore, Irish kings often made alliances with foreign invaders in an attempt to weaken their domestic rivals. The Vikings were able to defeat the centralised kingdoms of Europe since the small ruling class were easily removed. However, Ireland was composed of more than 150 different kingdoms ruling over small territories. This decentralized system of governments made it almost impossible to gain control of a territory, since defeated kings were easily replaced. And this is a similar thing that you can think of in England. If it was just a single country of England, then I think the Viking invasion would have been a lot more successful and England would have been completely taken over. Because they had to take over four big kingdoms, they couldn't do every one. That's why when Connaught obviously invaded England, he was able to successfully take it over because it was just one king. Four kings is very difficult to deal with. Never mind 150 different kings. So this is why it's very difficult. Having been forced to leave Dublin in 902 AD, the descendants of Ivar the Boneless, now described generically in the annals of Ulster, remained active around the Irish Sea. Reports tell of their activities in Picton, Strathclyde, Northumbria and the Man. In 914 AD, a new Viking fleet appeared, and soon Umar followed the people of Ivar, again taking control of Viking activities in Ireland. Different faces appeared in Ireland to help lead the armies of Vikings in the Irish area, such as Ragnall and Sitrick, but these people were defeated at the Battle of Confey. This victory allowed Sitrick to re-establish Norse control over Dublin. Ragnall left Ireland again in 918 AD and became King of York, which we discussed in last week's episode. With Sitrick in Dublin and Ragnall in York, a Dublin-York axis developed which would have influence on both England, Scotland and Ireland for the next half a century. A new and more intensive period of Viking settlement in Ireland began in 914 AD. Between 914 AD and 922 AD, the Norse established Waterford, Cork, Dublin, Wexford and Limerick. Dublin was secured for the Norse, and in 920 Sitrick left for York and followed Ragnall's death, succeeding him as ruler there in 921 AD. Their kingsman, Gofraid, assumed control of Dublin. Gofraid was active as a Viking raider and slaver, but there were signs during his reign that the Norse were just not mere Vikings anymore. Dublin's ambitions in Ulster were halted by a series of defeats inflicted upon the Norse by the son of Nial Gumbum, a king in Ireland. Again, when Sitrick died in York, Gofraid left for York, trying to assume kingship there. He was driven out by Æthelstan and returned to Dublin half a year later. The Vikings of Limerick had taken Dublin in his absence. Gofraid tried to take the city, but the struggle between Limerick continued well after Gofraid's death in 934 AD. He was succeeded by his son, who inflicted a decisive defeat on Limerick in 937 AD. For the next period, the Vikings continued to integrate themselves in Irish society, whilst the Irish kingdoms fought for the high kingship title and began to become a bit more consolidated into smaller kingdoms, not as big as 150 this time. Ireland would continue to be a struggling nation up until the English would arrive with their small invasion parties in the Middle Ages. I think that is a perfect time to end today's episode. We've obviously touched upon the Kingdom of Strathclyde, England, and the main continent of Ireland. Now, we have very much brushed through, you know, the Strathclydean history. the English history, the Irish history, you know, all could be their own podcasts with many episodes. So I do apologize if I've really sped through that, been really fast, maybe mispronounced a few things, may have been incorrect with some of the history that I told. It's just a brief overview to give you an idea of where England, Ireland and Strathclyde are at this time at the Kingdom of Alba when Cuillain is about to come to the throne. So just a quick recap, when Cuillain's about to come to the throne, you've got the Kingdom of England, you've got the Kingdom of Strathclyde, and then you've got the Irish, many kingdoms with Vikings integrated into their society, similar to how the Danelaw and English integrated their society. But as always, if there's any issues or corrections with this episode, because as I did go through quite a lot, please email me at historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com and I can correct it in the next episode. Next week's episode will be us finishing off this grand tour, with us touching upon the Scandinavian and Vikings in Britain as a whole, as well as obviously their own country, since obviously the Vikings have taken a massive part of our time in these episodes, touching upon when they invaded Scotland, England, Ireland. You know, I think we should dedicate some time to at least understanding where they came from. After that, we'll head to the continent, discuss the European kingdoms such as the Kingdom of Francia, and then we'll discuss Christianity and the Pope and its effect on the Kingdom of Alba. Then after that after part two, we'll go into the day of a life of a Pict around the 950s AD, seeing what was life like back then. After that episode, we'll return to our main story and carry on with our new King of Alba, Cuillain, and discuss his descendants and the family feud between Malcolm I's descendants and Indulf's descendants, obviously from the Constantine side of the family. As always, please leave a review if you can. Our podcast, as always, is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, and Google Podcasts. Please leave a review if you've enjoyed this series. Next week's episode will be on Wednesday, Thursday. We'll see on the exact date when we get nearer to the time. But until then, stay safe, have a great week, and I'll catch you guys on the next one. Peace.